recognition. Okay, let's unpack this. We are about to ascend into a highly specialized, intensely secretive world. The world of the Doomsday Plane.
Right, and that name, it's not official, of course.
No, not at all. But it's the popular, dramatic name for a class of aircraft that serves one chillingly crucial function.
Ensuring the continuity of government and military command, even after the unthinkable has happened.
It is the ultimate shortcut to survival.
And our mission in this deep dive is to explore these airborne command posts, detailing their true purpose, their unique technological profile, and the specific models.
And the models are used by only two countries known to design and manufacture them, the United States and the Russian Federation.
Exactly. For you, the listener, this is essentially a fast-track tour of the highest-stakes airframes in existence. We're talking platforms where billions are spent to hedge against an absolute strategic collapse.
Precisely. The core function here is, well, it's unambiguous. These planes are not about presidential travel.
Not like Air Force One.
Not at all. They are designed to serve as an airborne command post in the event of nuclear war, a massive disaster, or any large-scale conflict that threatens to wipe out key infrastructure on the ground.
They are, quite simply, flying war rooms built for systemic survival.
And the continuation of deterrence.
When you think about national defense, you often focus on the weapons, right? The missiles, the submarines, the fighters.
Of course.
But none of that matters without the ability to issue orders and manage the response. These planes are the ultimate C2 system command and control.
So the brain of the operation.
The brain that has to survive, even if the capital city does not. That's the foundational philosophy here.
So let's begin with that absolute necessity of resilience. If we look at the anatomy of these craft, we immediately understand why they're so specialized.
Right. In the United States, they bypass that doomsday plane moniker.
So what's the official name?
They're known as National Airborne Operations Centers, or NAOCs.
NACs.
And that official name, it really highlights the scope of the mission. The platform's entire purpose is to allow the nation's highest leaders.
The National Command Authority.
Exactly. To allow them to issue commands, wage war, and maintain strategic control from the sky far removed from ground zero.
And the requirements for that task must be extraordinary.
They are. This isn't just a tough plane. It's an engineering marvel designed to survive the very definition of electronic chaos.
The level of modification required is, I mean, it's genuinely staggering. These modifications are what truly separate them from any standard jet.
That's the key. The sources make it clear that they feature a vast array of defense mechanisms, which are often misunderstood.
People think anti-missile flares, things like that.
Right. But the real threats they're built to survive are far more subtle and systemic.
So what are we talking about specifically?
We are talking about their ability to withstand the electromagnetic pulse, or EMP.
EMP. I've heard the term, but what does it actually do?
Well, an EMP is generated by high-altitude nuclear detonation. It's this rapid burst of electromagnetic radiation.
Okay.
And it couples with electronic systems, inducing massive instantaneous surges of electricity.
And what would that do to, say, a standard commercial airliner flying nearby?
Complete catastrophic failure. Modern aircraft rely entirely on fly-by-wire systems, navigation computers, communication suites.
All digital.
All digital. And a significant EMP would instantly disable virtually all of it across an area potentially hundreds of miles wide. The NAOC, however, has to be hardened, shielded, and survivable.
So how do they do that?
Yeah.
You can't just, you know, slap a sticker on a 747 and call it EMP proof.
No, it requires a deep physical redesign of the airframe. You're essentially turning the entire aircraft into a layered defense system. At its core, you have the principle of the Faraday cage.
Right, like in science class.
Exactly. The metallic skin of the aircraft acts as the outer layer, aiming to shunt that energy around the interior. But it doesn't stop there.
There's more.
Oh, yes. All critical electronics are encased in additional hardened, shielded boxes. Think of nested Russian dolls with each layer designed to dissipate energy.
So they have to isolate every single critical circuit. That sounds like an absolute nightmare for the engineers.
It is, especially when you consider the sheer volume of communications equipment they carry. They use extensive filtering, special bonding of metal joints to prevent entry points, and miles upon miles of specialized shielded cabling.
So the wiring alone must be incredibly complex.
Exponentially more complex and heavier than a standard 747. Every single cable, especially those entering the plane from external antenna, has to be isolated and protected against surges. It's an approach that prioritizes resilience over everything else.
And speaking of maintaining function, there is a genuinely surprising detail in the sources about cybersecurity. It feels, well, incredibly counterintuitive today.
It's the ultimate paradox of modern strategic design, isn't it?
Tell us.
The crews piloting these highly advanced, immensely powerful aircraft, they use traditional analog flight instruments to navigate.
Wait, what? You mean like classic dials and gauges?
Exactly. Dials, gauges, and mechanical systems.
That is genuinely shocking. Why revert to technology that is functionally decades old?
Because, and the sources state this explicitly, these analog instruments are less susceptible to cyber attack. When the stakes are global survival, you cannot risk a software glitch, a corrupted update, or an adversary gaining remote access to the flight controls. Analog systems are physical. They respond to inputs based on physics, not code.
It's the ultimate expression of redundancy through, what, technological regression?
You could call it that. They rely on systems that require a physical presence to manipulate. It just eliminates those remote digital vulnerabilities entirely.
So the designers are planning for a scenario where not only the power grid, but the entire global network structure, internet, GPS, satellite timing, it's all collapsed or been compromised.
Absolutely. Their design philosophy is when everything else fails, we must still be able to fly in command.
And that complexity, it just underscores the fact that these aren't ferrying dignitaries.
No, they are flying command centers. They are staffed not by a small flight crew, but by dozens of military analysts, intelligence strategists, and specialized communication aides.
All prepared to guide the president through the first most chaotic days of a nuclear war.
And their operational context is what defines them. These aircraft have been in operation in various forms since the 1970s. For a long time, they were considered the best, maybe the only, chance for a Cold War president to survive an initial attack.
But they're not technically secret.
Not technically, no. You can find details about them, but they're very rarely mentioned. The U.S. Air Force, for instance, won't even publicly acknowledge owning some of them.
So acknowledged, but kept firmly in the operational shadows.
You're always ready.
That high-stakes mission brings us directly to the specific platforms. Let's jump into the core U.S. fleet, starting with the big one, the Boeing E-4B.
The flagship.
Right. It's officially the Advanced Airborne Command Post, but its project name is the fittingly dramatic Night Watch.
And the E-4 series was modified from a commercial platform known for endurance and massive payload capacity, the sturdy, powerful Boeing 747-200B.
That choice makes sense. The 747 was a workhorse. Four powerful engines could fly forever.
Exactly. And you need that capability because the E-4B carries far more than passengers. It carries dozens of staff, massive server racks, and all that physical shielding we just talked about.
And its mission is crystal clear. It is the survivable mobile command post for the National Command Authority.
The NCA.
So the President, the Secretary of Defense, and their designated successors.
Right. If all fixed command centers like the Pentagon or the White House are gone, the E-4B becomes the temporary capital of the nation.
The legal and strategic center of government just in the air.
And to facilitate that, it's designed to fly for extended periods. With aerial refueling, the airframe could theoretically stay airborne for days.
Limited only by engine oil and crew fatigue.
That's it. And inside, it's not just a big plane, it's segmented into six functional areas. You have the NCA area, a conference room, briefing room, operations team area, communications, even a rest area.
A flying Pentagon.
Literally.
Now, what's really interesting here is the current status of the E-4B fleet. It's not just a Cold War relic, it's undergoing a massive modernization push.
A huge one. And it reveals so much about strategic procurement today. Sierra Nevada Corporation won the contract to develop the successor.
Beating up Boeing, the original developer.
Which is a very significant development. This new program is called SAOC Survivable Airborne Operations Center.
So they are sticking with the 747 platform.
They are, but a much newer version.
This is where it gets really interesting, particularly with the timeline. Sierra Nevada will be using 5 Korean Air Boeing 747-8s.
Relatively new, 4-engine passenger jets now being converted. And the sources tell us these base planes are expected to be delivered to the corporation by 2025.
So next year.
But, and this is the massive strategic insight, while the planes are arriving soon, the full conversion process.
Installing all the specialized gear, the EMP shielding, everything.
Yes. That entire process is slated to be completed by July 2036.
2036. That is over a decade of continuous top priority modification work. Why so long? Is it just bureaucracy?
No, it overwhelmingly reflects the technical complexity. You can't just protect against the threats of today. You have to protect against the kinetic, electronic, and cyber threats of 2050.
Future-proofing.
Absolutely. That decade-plus timeline illustrates the sheer complexity and the absolute necessity of rigorous testing and certification. Every single component must be proven to function perfectly under the harshest possible conditions. Speed is secondary to absolute certainty.
Must also require massive re-engineering. The 742-7-8 is way more modern than the old Natchez 200B.
It is. It has more commercial, non-hardened digital components that have to be completely stripped out and replaced with custom-built EMP hardened systems.
So you're taking a state-of-the-art passenger plane and forcing it back into a high-reliability, low-digital military architecture.
It's a process of highly customized demilitarization, followed by intensive remilitarization, a job where precision trumps everything.
Okay, so if the E-4B is the decision-making engine, the mobile capital. We need to look at the E6 Mercury.
The trigger mechanism.
Exactly. Issuing an order from the E4B is only half the battle. The other half is making sure the weapons actually receive it.
And that brings us to the E6. Its primary function is communication relay and coordination.
And it's built on a different airframe.
An older one, the Boeing 707-320. And a fascinating piece of aviation history here. Production of the E6 lasted until 1994, making it the final new derivative of the classic Boeing 707 to ever be built.
Wow. The very end of that lineage.
Adapted for the ultimate strategic purpose.
And the E6 has been with the U.S. Navy since July 1989. What's fascinating is its primary mission, known by the acronym TACAMO.
Take charge and move out.
What does that mean in practice?
TACAMO is the lifeblood of strategic deterrence. It focuses on the most critical component of the nuclear triad, the Fleet Ballistic Missile Submarines, or SSBNs.
The boomers.
Right. They're the most survivable leg of the triad because they're submerged, constantly moving. They're the guaranteed retaliatory force.
So if all terrestrial communication is destroyed,
the E6 ensures that those submerged strategic assets can still receive launch orders from the National Command Authority.
How does it even do that? How do you communicate with a sub that's hundreds of feet underwater? Standard radio doesn't work.
This is where physics becomes a matter of national survival. They use a system called very low frequency, or VLF, communication.
VLF.
The waves have extremely long wavelengths. We're talking kilometers. And these long waves are the only ones that can penetrate seawater deep enough to be received by a submerged submarine.
And I'm guessing that requires a massive antenna.
A truly enormous one. The aircraft is essentially dragging an extremely long wire antenna behind it.
How long?
Up to 5 miles long, lowered from the tail of the plane.
5 miles? How do you keep a 5 mile long wire vertical while flying a jet at high speeds?
You don't fly in a straight line. The E6 pilots perform highly specialized, slow speed maneuvers, often flying in tight, deep figure eight patterns at altitude.
And that does what?
This low-skade, high-G maneuver allows gravity to pull the trailing wire straight down, maximizing the verticality of the VLF signal transmission to the submarines below.
That's an incredible act of specialized aviation.
It is, performed by the Navy specifically to ensure the command chain is never broken.
So the E-6 is the ultimate emergency signal booster for the submerged deterrent, and its capability expanded with the E-6B model, right?
Deployed in 1998, yes. While the E-6A focused on the submarines, the E-6B integrated the capability to remotely control the land-based nuclear arsenal as well.
So missiles in silos.
Exactly. It added the Airborne Launch Control System, or ALCS. This means the E-6B can bypass compromised ground facilities and remotely transmit launch commands to Minuteman ICBMs across the U.S.
So we have a really clear division of labor here. The E-4B commands the leaders, acting as the mobile center of government.
While the E6 Mercury commands the nuclear triad components, ensuring the orders are actually delivered.
One is the brain, the other is the nervous system.
The nervous system connecting the brain to the muscle of the retaliatory force. You need both to maintain deterrence.
This naturally leads us to a piece of the puzzle that never quite materialized, the Northrop Grumman E-10 MC-2A.
Right. And when we discuss these assets, it's just as important to understand the projects that were canceled. They reveal the strategic thinking of the era.
So what was the vision for the E-10?
It wasn't just a replacement for one plane. It was an incredibly ambitious multi-domain platform. It aimed to consolidate multiple strategic functions into a single airframe.
Based on the Boeing 767, when you say multi-role, you mean?
A massive, unprecedented scope. It was intended to replace four separate, distinct, and highly specialized aircraft lines.
Four. Which ones?
The E-3 Sentry AWACS for aerial surveillance, the E-8 Joint Stars for ground surveillance, the E-4B Command Post itself, and the RC-135 Rivet Joint for signals intelligence.
That is staggering. So instead of four different jets, you'd have one super platform that could do all of that.
That was the vision. The E-10 would have been the central command authority for all air, land, and sea forces in a combat theater, integrating intelligence and command on a single platform.
So why did it fail? The sources mention a pretty big contract was awarded back in 2003.
A $215 million contract, yes. The project ultimately succumbed to the sheer complexity and cost of integration.
Just too much to put in one box.
Exactly. Trying to fit four highly sophisticated, functionally distinct sensor packages, each with different power demands, cooling solutions, antenna configurations onto one airframe, proved too daunting.
Both technically and financially.
Right. It resulted in a system that was exponentially more complex and expensive than just maintaining and upgrading the separate fleets.
So it wasn't a failure of vision, but a failure of integration feasibility.
That's the key takeaway. It demonstrates the U.S. strategy of continuous but slower modernization. Sometimes specialized platforms are simply more reliable than an all-in-one system.
And crucially, the sources mention one forward-looking detail that ties back to our earlier discussion about the analog pilots.
The UCAVs.
Right. The E-10 was also considered for use as a command center for unmanned combat air vehicles.
And that detail is immensely important. It highlights the strategic move toward managing networked digital warfare from these highly resilient airborne hubs. The MC-2A, though unfulfilled, was a forward look at integrating autonomous systems into the high-stakes command chain.
Okay, now we execute a strategic turn and shift focus to the Russian Federation. They're the only other country known to possess this critical class of aircraft.
And the necessity of maintaining strategic control is clearly a shared priority. They need a high-reliability backup system, too.
So what does their fleet look like?
Well, the details are far more opaque, but the function is identical to the U.S. NAOC's. Their current known aircraft are the Ilyushin Il-80, often nicknamed Maxdome by NATO.
Maxdome.
And its counterpart, the Ilyushin Il-82.
And like their U.S. counterparts, the Il-80 is based on a modified commercial airframe.
That's right. The Ilyushin Il-86 passenger jet, a four-engine wide body designed for endurance. It's their equivalent workhorse.
The visual similarity to the E-4B is pretty striking.
It is, particularly one key feature. The Il-80 is famous for this enormous, highly distinct canoe-shaped dorsal bulge, the hump running along the top of the fuselage.
What's in there?
That bulge is believed to house the plane's massive satellite communication antenna and data links.
So it's for global communication when ground systems are down.
Precisely. It's their hardened command center, stripped of windows.
Which would be a vulnerability to EMP.
A major vulnerability. So it's optimized purely for command.
And just as the U.S. is planning a transition to the 747-8, Russia also has a future replacement plan.
They do. It confirms this capability is not seen as a Cold War relic, but as a continuous strategic investment. They're planning to replace the older IL-80s with a plane based on the much larger, more modern Ilyushin Il-96-400 Mead.
The strategic approach is remarkably similar.
It is. Both nations use large, modified, wide-body jets. Both ensure EMP shielding and robust communications. And both are planning multi-decade investments in the successors. It's a mutual recognition of the fragility of terrestrial command.
And while the technical specs are more guesswork, the IL-80 series has made headlines through some surprising anecdotal context.
Yes, the human element sometimes leaks out in deeply bizarre ways. The December 2020 incident stands out.
What happened?
Russian police launched a hunt for thieves who had plundered a top-secret doomsday plane while it was undergoing maintenance.
You're kidding. They broke into it.
They did. It's an incredible contrast, isn't it? The plane's purpose is to survive an apocalypse, and it's compromised by petty theft on the ground.
What was stolen?
Reports indicated roughly 39 pieces of radio equipment were taken from the cargo bay. And while the equipment itself is technical, its absence and the vulnerability it exposed raises serious questions about security protocols.
It underscores that even the most advanced defenses rely on basic physical security.
Entirely.
And there was another public appearance of the IL-80, more recently, in May 2022.
Direct. This wasn't a theft, it was a deliberate show of force. The plane's appearance during the annual Victory Day flybys was widely interpreted by observers as a potential warning to the West.
Especially given the geopolitical tensions at the time.
Right. And while we must remain impartial, the public display of such a sensitive, high-value asset immediately carries significant symbolic weight.
It's a statement. It says, we have not just the strike capability, but the resilient command system to coordinate a response no matter what.
Exactly. The planes themselves become part of the psychological deterrent. They advertise resilience.
So if we bring this discussion full circle, what does this all mean for someone tracking global strategic stability?
I think the existence, the design, and the continuous modernization of these aircraft, both U.S. and Russian, it highlights a unified strategic philosophy that really transcends politics.
And that philosophy is what?
That it relies on specialized platforms built entirely around surviving total systemic failure. The U.S. has the E-4B for command and the E-6 for communication. Every system, down to the analog flight instruments, is built to ensure the nation can retaliate or organize a defense, even if the national grid is gone.
The details of that resilience, the EMP shielding, the analog instruments, that 5-mile VLF antenna, it shows that designers are thinking about the deepest possible spectrum of threats.
They are preparing for a world where digital infrastructure has completely collapsed, forcing a return to the basics of command.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer financial and human investment, that multi-decade contract for the new 747s, it just underscores the absolute necessity of maintaining command and control.
C2 is deemed more important than the physical survival of any one fixed command structure. The priority is resilience and mobility.
Which brings us back to that provocative detail we noted about the unfulfilled E-10 program.
The unmanned combat air vehicles.
Right. Our discussion today focused heavily on resisting EMPs and cyber attacks. Specifically by leaning on analog instruments for navigation and physical hardening for command.
But the source material mentioned the E-10 was being considered for commanding those unmanned vehicles. And, well, this raises a critically important question for the future, something for you to mull or explore on your own.
In a future conflict where the strategic command aircraft, the flying war rooms, must be protected by using analog pilots and mechanical instruments.
Will the highly advanced, inherently digital drones and unmanned vehicles they're commanding still be the biggest vulnerability in the entire command chain?
It's the paradox of future warfare.
Can the ultra-resilient analog commander effectively control the ultra-vulnerable digital weapon? If the drone swarm is the future, but the command center has to rely on 1950s technology for survival, where does the security truly lie?
A thought to land on as you continue your own deep dive.